Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has served with great distinction for decades in that war, including on some of the battlefronts that are least understood and the dangers associated with them least attended to, is our first guest. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He has served in numerous capacities at the Central Intelligence Agency for the better part of two decades as an analyst there, as a professional staff member for the House Armed Services Committee, as a senior member of the Congressional EMP Threat Commission. And we are delighted to catch up with him. As always, though regrettably, it is on the occasion of the passing of that important commission. Peter Pry, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to have you back.
Always a pleasure, Frank. Thank you.
I wanted to talk to you about the commission in a moment, but first, to get your sense, Peter, of what seemed to be ongoing and perhaps intensifying threats to use this so-called electromagnetic pulse attack scenario to destroy the electric grid emanating from Pyongyang, North Korea. What is the latest on that front, Peter, and how serious a threat do you think this poses?
Well, it's a clear and present danger for sure. The EMP Commission has been warning about it for years, and we have been right, while much of the U.S. government has been wrong. And this was proven as recently as September 2nd, when North Korea successfully tested a hydrogen bomb, which they described as also being capable at a setting for super powerful EMP attack. Even if it was not designed as a super EMP weapon, the weapon itself, which had a yield, now the yield keeps going up as they change the rest of it. It's now 250 kilotons. Just a normal hydrogen bomb of 250 kilotons could destroy the whole electric grid in all of North America. But with a super EMP setting, it would be even worse. And 2 days after the successful hydrogen bomb test, the North Koreans released a technical report titled The EMP Might of Nuclear Weapons, which accurately describes a super EMP weapon. Now, the latest, just this week, one of the other things the commission has been warning about is that the North Korean war plan, as Russia and China, their version of cyber warfare, includes EMP attack combined with cyber operations. So we now find that the North Koreans have been trying to use cyber operations to penetrate U.S. power grids, which is perfectly consistent with the doctrine we've been talking about, where they combine cyber attacks with nuclear EMP attack to basically bring down the grid. And as Congressman Weldon wrote in an article on the Hill, only Washington bureaucrats could be so stupid that they would discontinue the EMP commission in the very month that North Korea has tested a hydrogen bomb and made EMP attacks against the United States.
Or made threats thereof. Peter Pry, let me ask you about what we've learned that really has given vivid affirmation to the warnings of the EMP Threat Commission in Puerto Rico in the aftermath of most recently Hurricane Maria. Talk, if you would, quickly, Peter, about what a grid down situation is like in 21st century America.
By coincidence, Frank, I was just writing an article about how the situation in Puerto Rico is like an EMP attack. Here you've got a situation where the grid has been out just for days, for a couple of weeks, and the critical, life-sustaining critical infrastructures are in paralysis, and there's no food, no water. The communications and transportation systems are so severely compromised that even with all the massive efforts of the United States government to help, they're having difficulty getting help where it's needed. And it's even hard to know where the help is required. And this is an island, which is, you know, because it's an island and not that big an island, it would be a lot easier to to get help into Puerto Rico than it would into the continental United States if we were to have lost our grid, you know, which is why I'm sure the average Puerto Rican has no problem, who's living amidst this catastrophe every day, has no problem imagining that if their circumstance were to continue for a year, that most of the population of the island would probably be dead from starvation, disease, and societal collapse.
Unless, of course, there was a considerable intervention by outside powers, and notably in this case the United States. But who would come to our rescue in a similar grid down situation on the continental United States?
Right, which is happening in Puerto Rico. So fortunately, mass starvation will be avoided, and with God's help, a pandemic avoided. But I'll tell you, Frank, I would like to send the editorial board of Popular Mechanics and their authors down to Puerto Rico to help out for a while, because they keep publishing articles mocking former CIA Director Jim Woolsey for citing that figure from the CIA, that up to 9 of 10 Americans could die from in the aftermath of an EMP attack. Puerto Rico is an object lesson in exactly how that could happen. If those circumstances, if there were no ability to rescue, and these circumstances continued for a year, it's obvious what would happen. You know, you don't have to be a nuclear scientist to figure out that Puerto Rico desperately needs to be rescued, and those people would die if the U.S. government weren't there to save them.
Yeah. Dr. Peter Pry, we're talking at a moment when the Secretary of Energy is testifying before the Congress. This program airs, it will have happened. He is presumably going to be speaking about and challenged over recommendations that he has made now, in fact, directives that he has made to have coal-fired power plants and other power-generating facilities increase their reserves of feedstock so as to enhance the resiliency of the grid. Would you ascribe great importance to this initiative? And if so, I'm told that two of the three serving members of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission have kind of dissed the whole idea, one of them actually tweeting that they would rather quit than implement it. What is up with that, Peter?
I wholeheartedly endorse what Secretary Perry is doing. In the 2008 EMP Commission report, he's stockpiling reserves of fuel to run electrical generating plants is among the EMP Commission recommendations in terms of it being exactly what we should be doing to try to fortify our country against an EMP or cyber attack or other or natural threats that could result in a grid down situation. And all I can say about the FERC, it's par for the course. It's as if the FERC members have had an unerring ability to do exactly what North Korea, Russia, China, and Iran want the United States to do. Their policies always seem to favor a posture of unpreparedness and nakedness to the threat of our enemies.
It's shocking. That's exactly the opposite of their responsibilities, the last time I checked, right?
Yes, exactly, exactly. But I think what political scientists call it is we've got a situation of regulatory capture, where the industry that they're supposed to oversee has captured control of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and at least of those two commissioners who clearly don't want to do the right thing. Now, we've got a few new commissioners on board, including a Mr. Powelson, who used to be on the staff of Congressman Curt Weldon, you know, one of the champions of EMP protection. Dr. Graham and I had an opportunity to meet with him not long ago, and he might be a different breed. So there's at least hope from coming from one possible commissioner, new commissioner, on the FERC. But one man isn't enough, and he's not the chairman. This is a very discouraging, but par for the course in terms of the behavior of the FERC. Ultimately, what I think has to happen, Frank, is, you know, what the commission has recommends is we need different institutional relationships. FERC and NERC just can't be trusted to protect the electric grid. You know, this responsibility has to go elsewhere.
Yeah, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation being essentially a trade association, which largely sets the standards, which the FERC has typically, as you say, in a regulatory capture mode, ratified by rubber stamp. Peter Pry, we have to leave it at that, I'm sorry to say. There's so much more to discuss. I'm very anxious to hear about the final reports that the EMP Commission, on which you have served so ably for so long, is now preparing, finalizing, submitting. These are critical resources, as Congressman Kurt Weldon noted, more needed now than ever. Thank you for your service to our country in the past and that is ongoing. I know you'll stay in touch with us, and we'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. Next up, Peter Husey joins us. We'll get a sense of how we're doing with respect to deterring the sorts of attacks that Peter Price just discussed. That and much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Peter Husey, the president of Geostrategic Analysis and the head of strategic studies at the Mitchell Institute. He is one of the go-to guys, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to thinking about and helping the rest of us understand the challenges to our nuclear deterrent posture and what it will take to overcome them. Peter Husey, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Nice to talk to you, Frank.
We were speaking in the previous segment with Peter Pry about some of the threats that have been emerging from North Korea of late, Peter, specifically with respect to electromagnetic pulse attacks. And I wanted to just to get your sense. You've written recently at the Gatestone Institute about the necessity of being clear-eyed about our enemies as they are, not as we would wish them to be. How are we doing in that regard at the moment, not just with respect to North Korea, but for that matter, Iran, Russia, China?
Well, I think, Frank, the reason there is angst within the conventional wisdom folks on Iran, North Korea, China, and Russia is that you have an administration that, in fact, sees countries as they are, and their strategy and rhetoric has been commensurate with that concern. And that's what's caused people to go get, as General Powell once said, they all have a case of the vapors. I think in every one of those instances, the administration, having been handed a pretty bad state of the world, has been all moving in the right direction. As you know, no administration moves as fast as we want or as fast often as the bad guys operate, but I think they're doing the right job. I think there's something that is in the news that we ought all to look at very seriously. Mr. Putin was interviewed and said that he met with Kim's father in North Korea in the summer of 2000 when he was told the North Koreans had nuclear weapons, and that he said this publicly. He said this in video now, and it's on the record. And this was exactly the time when Madeleine Albright was traveling to North Korea and Bill Clinton had reduced sanctions on North Korea to encourage them to invite our Secretary of State. What does that tell you? It tells you that the North Koreans were cheating on the deal, that the Russians knew they were cheating on the agreed framework, and our administration was busy conceding and making eliminating some of the sanctions in order to make more deals with the Secretary of State there. I think it was Bill Clinton was going to go and do a summit or something in North Korea.
Peter, this raises the concern that we may be doing pretty much the same thing at the moment with respect to North Korea's strategic ally, Iran. Talk a little bit about that. We're going to be discussing it further with Fred Flight shortly, but I'm interested in your take on it.
Well, as you know, I signed the letter that John Bolton put together saying I think we should get out of the deal altogether. If it's submitted to the Senate as a proposal to decertify, and then the Senate would reimpose sanctions, my hope is the Senate would have a debate on the Iran deal and say, do we want to continue this deal, sanctions or no sanctions? And my hope is that you have enough votes in the Senate to say, this deal is not only inadequate with respect to the nuclear program in Iran, it's totally inadequate for all the other things it doesn't talk about, which are human rights, missiles, ballistic missile development, conventional modernization, and Iran's huge panoply of terror groups that they support, give sanctuary to, finance, and arm. When you have the Houthis in Yemen throwing ballistic missiles at targets all over Saudi Arabia, and then you have people writing in some of the blogs in Washington about that it's a myth that Iran is helping the Houthis. The question is, where is the ballistic missile factories in Yemen that are building these rockets? And it, the blindness here, remember Andy McCarthy wrote a book called Willful Blindness about the lack of understanding terrorism we were facing. And then Condi Rice said they were at war with us, but we didn't figure that out. Well, what do you think Iran's been doing since 1979? The military says they've killed 500 Americans with IEDs in Iraq. We know they were responsible for Khobar Towers and the Beirut bombing and also 9/11. In part, they were training the hijackers.
But Peter, let me bring you back to the point you were making earlier, and that is these rogue states, for want of a better term, have made very little secret of the fact that they hold agreements with nations like us in contempt. They make them and break them routinely. Are there specific lessons from the experience of the Clinton administration, and for that matter, Republican administrations as well with the North Koreans, and the present undertaking, the debate that we're having now? The president may, in the aftermath of this show's recording, announce what he's going to do about this so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Should we be under any illusion that the Iranians are cheating and will, of course, persist in building nuclear weapons capabilities with which to act on those threats to bring death to America?
We shouldn't be under an illusion. I think the problem we face, Frank, is that the proponents of the deal say that the alternative is war. And when Reagan became president, as you know, I'm working on a project called the Reagan Legacy Project to look at the lessons of the Cold War, which was what my Gatestone Institute essay was about. Reagan came in and did regime change and all over Eastern Europe. All those communist countries became what? Relatively free. And he did it with a whole panoply of financial sanctions on trade issues, on military capability, going after these wars of national liberation, doing the strategic and conventional modernization, helping NATO and the INF missile deployments. As you know, we did everything from A to Z. And what you have in Washington is, as soon as someone says, well, we'll talk with North Korea. And the question is, okay, about what? To what end? What are they bringing to the table? Because they've said we're not going to talk about our nukes, so what are we talking about? When you say military options aren't available, you tell the North Koreans, don't worry, there's no military option that makes any sense, so you're free to basically do what you want to do. And my view is, get serious. Stop playing this wink game of pretending like strategic patience or leading from behind or soft power or reset or smart power. This administration knows this. But we should have no illusions that these people are, you know, as someone wrote recently, as Frank Miller wrote, signing a piece of paper doesn't work with these people because they cheat and lie and steal on everything they sign.
I understood. Let me ask you, Peter, as a serious expert on our nuclear deterrent, to talk for a minute about its condition. There was this fake news story out of NBC that the president had decided he wanted to essentially magnify by 10 times the number of nuclear weapons that we had. He's you know, repudiated that, as his General Mattis. What could we be doing? What should we be doing, as you see it, in terms of enhancing our strategic deterrent, given the condition it's in at the moment?
Well, my view is that the current plan that's on the table that the Senate and House have approved, if you want to accelerate it, I think we should. But we have a bomber now ready under contract. We have two companies that have been selected to do risk reduction for Minuteman and a new ground-based ICBM. And we have the submarine Columbia classes already under contract and going to be rebuilt. We need to do command and control and communication. That's critical. That's part of it. And the warheads in terms of the National Nuclear Strategic Administration, Security Administration, that's part of the mix. We're talking about $28 billion now, probably going up to $36 billion at its peak. And over a period of 30 years, we're going to be spending somewhere around $750 billion. But compare that $30 billion you're going to spend on nukes to a defense budget of close between $650 and $700 billion and a national budget of between $4 and $5.5 trillion over the next 10 years.
It's small and it's absolutely necessary, I think, is the bottom
line. Without which, as Mattis says, you're dead. You don't have the top cover to make sure that crises don't become conflicts and conventional conflicts don't end up with nuclear warheads running around. You know, for 70 years, nuclear warheads have never been used. since the end of World War II, and that is because America's been strong, not because America decided to be weak.
Amen. Peter Husey, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today, as always, and for the great work you're doing at Geostrategic Analysis and at the Mitchell Institute. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Fred Flights about some of these Iran capers, specifically the next steps on this so-called Obama bomb deal. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Fred Flights, the Senior Vice President of the Center for Security Policy for Policy and Programs, a career intelligence professional with some 20 years of service in the Central Intelligence Agency, time working for Ambassador John Bolton when he was Undersecretary of State, serving as his Chief of Staff, and also as a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee. He is the author of Obama Bomb, a Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud, countless periodical articles and other contributions to the public debate, most immediately, about this Iran deal. Fred Flights, it's good to have you back. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Good to be here, Frank.
Well, you have been following probably as closely, if not closer than just about anybody I know, the latest drama in Washington. The president is expected at any time, perhaps today, perhaps tomorrow at the Family Research Council Value Voters Summit, to declare his intentions with respect to this deal. He said he's made up his mind about it. I'd like to ask you first and foremost, the immediate decision before him is whether to certify two things. One, that Iran is in compliance with the deal, and two, that it is in the national security interests of the United States. Fred, give us your understanding of the facts on both counts.
Well, I might add that that what you just said is true, but there's also another caveat, and that is whether we will impose sanctions after the president supposedly decertifies. And yet another option is to pull out of the deal completely, which is what Ambassador Bolton was talking about. But concerning Iranian compliance, it's first worth noting that Iran can pursue a nuclear weapon and be in full compliance with this agreement. And this is something that Benjamin Netanyahu has noted, because Iran can continue to enrich uranium with over 5,000 centrifuges, develop advanced centrifuges, and it will be given a reactor that produces plutonium. Even though this reactor will not produce a lot of plutonium, it will still produce a quarter of a weapon's worth of plutonium per year, and it gives Iran expertise in how to build these reactors. Iran should never have one of these because of its past cheating. And there has been cheating. Iran has failed to meet the standards of the agreement. It has produced too much low-enriched uranium. It has refused to allow the IAEA access to military facilities, which is a very significant violation.
A material breach, would you say?
This is a material breach. Now, it's interesting. The IAEA has issued reports saying they haven't found evidence of Iranian noncompliance. The reason is they haven't asked to go to these facilities. When the IAEA director asserted that they could go there a couple of weeks ago, the Iranians immediately shut back and said, no, no foreigners will be allowed into these places. I also think it's very, very likely that Iran and North Korea are collaborating on their nuclear programs like they have on their missile programs. We know Iranian officials have been seen at North Korean nuclear and missile tests. And finally, there have been German intelligence reports in 2016 and 2017 of secret efforts by Iran to acquire nuclear technology in violation of the agreement. A new report just came out this week from one of these German intelligence agencies. It's a German state intelligence agency that details this, multiple instances of this happening. The fact that they're in noncompliance is not a close call, despite what people on the other side are saying.
Yeah. And as to the question of whether it is in the national security interests of the United States to preserve this deal by remaining in it, Fred Flights, are the facts as clear in that regard?
I think clearly this agreement has emboldened Iran. Its behavior has gotten significantly worse. And the president was right that this was a terrible agreement. John Kerry gave away everything he could to get it.
missiles were supposed to be in it, I might add, but at the last minute, the Iranians said they wouldn't agree to missiles being included. Missiles are part of a nuclear weapons program. They're the delivery system. Everyone knows that. And they were excluded because Kerry desperately wanted a deal. Hmm.
So, Fred Flights, let's just, for the purpose of discussion, say that the president remains convinced the deal has been violated by the Iranians and that it is not in our interest. The reporting suggests, and this includes your own reporting, that he may go with one of two options, what you've called the dumb and dumber options, as opposed to doing what Ambassador Bolton has recommended, what dozens of national security experts, including thee and me, have recommended he do, which is to cut and cut clean, I think was John Bolton's reference to a famous Paul Laxalt expression. What is your understanding, Fred Flights, of the current state of play with respect to these so-called dumb and dumber option?
Well, National Security Advisor McMaster and Secretary of State Tillerson basically try to come up with a way for the president to decertify the deal and stay in it. Because in July, the president was so angry, he wasn't given any options to leave the deal. So they came up with two options, the dumb option, which I've called it. If the president decertifies, we stay in the deal and additional sanctions are imposed. The dumber option is we decertify, stay in the deal, and we don't impose additional sanctions, either Congress or the administration, to give Tillerson and the State Department time to negotiate a better deal. Also, the certification requirement goes away in the second option. I regret that that is the leading option, and I understand the president may adopt. It's the dumber option because it's exactly what Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama would have done if they were in the White House right now. It protects this agreement because it keeps us in it, and it removes the prospect of sanctions. It's a terrible, terrible option.
Well, and also the fact that it removes the necessity with regularity to attest that, you know, the two obvious, sensible conditions are in fact operating. One, that the other party is complying with its terms, and two, that it is in fact in our interests. Making that, you know, requirement go away is only likely, it seems to me, to further reduce future Iranian compliance and further make it less and less in our interest. Fred, you mentioned Congress. One of the concerns, I guess, is that there seems to be little appetite on the part of people in Congress to reinstitute the kinds of sanctions that were previously on Iran that I believe President Obama foolishly, in his own wisdom, decided to remove at the very beginning of the deal, not based on performance by the Iranians later on. Your thoughts on that?
There are other experts in this town who should know better, who think that Congress will step up and pass additional sanctions if we go down this decertified but remain in the deal. That's not going to happen. There are too many moderate Republicans who've already said they don't want to do this. Senator Flake is one of them. Senator Paul is another one. Senator McCain is reluctant. There's at least three or four others. So there's only 52 Republicans. The Democrats are going to hang together. They're not going to pass significant additional sanctions that could force Iran to get out of this agreement. This is just a scheme to keep the president in this deal, even though he said during the campaign he would tear it up.
A promise that he needs to honor, it seems to me. Finally, Fred Flights, Adam Credo, our friend at the Washington Free Beacon, is reporting this morning that the Iranians seem to be very much on a path to breaking out of this agreement, not just violating it at the margins or even material breaches, but simply going for it in terms of finishing their nuclear buildup program. Your thoughts on that report?
You know, I think that's exactly right. There's this argument that the Iranians got into this deal because they were forced to do so by sanctions. That's actually not the case. Iran joined the deal because they had got the nuclear program to a particular point. They had perfected enrichment to such a point, and they would be able to continue to enrich under the agreement, and they'd get $1.7 billion and a $400 million ransom payment to release American hostages. Their nuclear weapons program never stopped, and I think it's continuing on military sites. And every day they enrich uranium is another day they're learning how to make more nuclear weapons fuel.
Yeah. And that's a bad thing from the point of view of the security of the United States, its friends and allies and interests in this world. I pray that President Trump will reflect that clear factual basis for getting out of this deal, as your old boss, Ambassador John Bolton, has recommended and we have supported at the Center for Security Policy. Thank you for your work there, Fred Flights. Look forward to talking with you again next week. Christine Brim is up next. We'll talk with her about the prospects for freedom of speech in America and what it might mean for you. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Christine Brim, one of the people I admire most in Washington these days. She is the executive director of a new organization, the Center for Policy Communications. Very proud to say, for many years, she was a chief operating officer of the Center for Security Policy, has been a valued colleague and an extraordinary resource in the public policy world, particularly as it relates to protecting freedom, which is, of course, what we're all about. Christine Brim, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Frank, it's great to be here and to talk to your audience.
Thank you. Well, listen, we're interested particularly in the work you've been doing on freedom of speech lately, and partly I just would like to sort of level set with you as to what is going on here. We're being buffeted by kind of conflicting polls, some of which have said by a margin of 85-8, I believe, two of them for that matter, McLaughlin and Rasmussen, that the public overwhelmingly supports freedom of speech, even if it might offend some people. But certain populations or subsets of the population, particularly college students and some minorities, are actually saying, no, we don't want to be offended. That's certainly true of certain folks in the Muslim community. Where are we on freedom of speech? Is it at risk here, even though we have constitutional guarantees to protect it?
Well, I think that at this point in history, freedom of speech, freedom of expression is under attack as it never has been before, possibly centuries ago. But the sheer scope of the ability of social media companies and international governments, the European Union, others, to completely stop freedom of speech is greater than it has been in the past. And we see the influence, for example, of the European Union kind of creeping into the understanding of people in the U.S. As to the difference between those two poles, I think the bedrock red America, red state America, the people that not only elected Trump, but just are generally representative of the majority of American citizens, absolutely are committed to the First Amendment, have some understanding of what's in it, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, which would mean that, for instance, the concept of a hate group is legally really shouldn't be defined in law. But I think that what we see are small groups of subsets who have been taught from kindergarten on or have been heavily propagandized to, but particularly for students, that there is no such thing as a valid constitution, that the founders were all racists and white supremacists, that the very concept of the United States of America is a kind of historical violation of some utopian ideal, and on and on.
So you're basically saying that this freedom of speech fight is a subset of a larger assault on the Republic, really, the Constitution that makes it possible.
By attacking freedom of speech as the first battle, if you will, against the Constitution and against the very idea of America, this enables them, potentially the left, the hard left, to then go after every aspect of constitutional liberties. What we're seeing in a concerted kind of coordinated effort here is an extraordinary attack in the United States that is being done at multiple levels. It's being done with a bill that just, or a resolution that just passed and became a public law because it was a joint resolution, which brought into law for the first time the terms xenophobic, hate group, anti-immigrant, as if without defining them, but making them something which we, as a country now, Trump signed it, all repudiate. So the precedent is set that those terms now actually mean something. We see it in, of course, the activities of the Southern Poverty Law Center and related groups. We see it across a host of efforts by large tech companies, be it Google or YouTube, to begin censoring content. We see it in the deplatforming of Twitter, Facebook, go on and on. And all of these groups, it's important to keep in mind, signed in May of 2016 an agreement with the European Union saying that they would enforce European laws against hate speech, which was specifically defined at that time as xenophobic. So all of them agreed that they would enforce European Union laws.
So let's talk a little bit about it. You've been very much involved in and monitoring what's happening in Europe for some time, also Canada, I believe. What is the template that we must expect if we accede to these kinds of, well, extensions of European Union hate speech restrictions into our country, Christine Brim, and the larger agenda that's behind, it would appear, this resolution, which more than 70 groups in our country and individuals, many of them quite prominent leaders in expressing sentiments that are deemed to be unacceptable by some, have written to the congressional leadership and to the president protesting this law and the possibility that there may be more in the wings. Talk about that, if you would, too.
Well, and there is a law in the wings, Senate Bill 662, the so-called No Hate Act, and that would, in fact, begin implementing the European model. And the European model is what we're seeing implemented already here in outside of law, which is, traditionally, we have crimes, and then if there's a bias component, we call it a hate crime. That's the way that this has been done since the late 90s in the United States. However, or actually since the late 80s, 1980s. However, what's being done now is an effort to expand that to any incident of hate, which doesn't mean there's a crime involved. It means someone decides that hate was involved, and including hate speech, and of course the broadly defined, anyone can call it, hate group. All of these terms are institutionalized in law in Europe and are used to shut down typically not just groups that may in fact be, you know, violent, which is a different issue, but they're used to shut down any group that is critical of the far left agenda or the Islamist agenda. And by shut down, I don't just mean that they, you know, ban you from Twitter or the kinds of things we're seeing for U.S. groups. No, I mean people go to jail. People go to court, they're fined, and sometimes people go to jail. So we're seeing this now, for example, one quick example, besides the various lists that the Southern Poverty Law Center puts together, which are blacklists, which become, as we know, hate lists, hit lists, because they influenced shooters, both of Stephen Scalise and Floyd Corkins was the shooter who attacked the Family District Council. But we also see, give you a quick example, the American Bar Association, in cooperation with the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Southern Poverty Law Center, ProPublica, and a George Soros-funded new entity for this year called Communities Against Hate, which into which he has put tens of millions of dollars to fund close to 100 groups, including many branches of care, to begin doing this infrastructure of the hate racket. All of these groups coalesced into a website called Hate Crime Help. And Hate Crime Help is a place where people can report so-called bias incidents or what they call verbal hate, which is the first type of infraction that they list in a drop-down list. And it is so appallingly outside of equal protection under the law. Just to give you one quick example, if you report gender as a bias motivation, you are only given the option of gender female. There is no gender male, which can be used as a bias motivation. So this kind of thing is going on widespread to create a parallel infrastructure. I call it the hate crime, the hate racket at this point, because people are raising money on this.
Yeah, they are making money on it, and they are also silencing people, at least beginning to intimidate some, and in due course will, if they have their way, prosecute others of us. Christine Brim, you are at the forefront of this fight. Thank you for the work you're now doing at the Center for Policy Communications. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. And the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.